Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Later in the hour, we hear some of the musicians featured in this summer's Provincetown Jazz Festival. They're offering the Cape's first trumpet summit. But first, the ocean has long been used as a receptacle for unwanted items. It's also a place where items and lives can quickly be lost. When those items wash up on the shore or are exposed in shifting sands, years or decades later, they link us to the history of the people and the place. Lost and Found, Time, Tide, and Treasures is a new book showcasing beachcombers who are also artists. Some of the artists use the found objects in their work. Others use pieces as inspiration. Joining us to talk more about the book are the authors Amy Heller and Gail Brown, who are among the artists featured in the book. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Also with us, another artist featured in the book, Paul Bowen. Welcome to you as well.
Hi, thank you so much for having me too.
So many people who walk the beaches love to collect shells, rocks, and sea glass. These are some of the more common items, along with plastic trash that we see along the beach. But you flip through your book, and it's amazing to see the many different types of objects found. And these are just the items found on beaches in Provincetown. Amy, why did you narrow the focus of the book to artifacts and artists in Provincetown?
Because Provincetown is my second ancestral home. My parents honeymooned there in 1949. I've been going there every summer since I was a baby. And so it holds a special place for me. And these people are special to me as well. So it's the connection to Provincetown and the connection to these people.
Gail, how long have you been collecting items from the beaches of Provincetown, and do you remember some of the first things that you found when you started collecting?
I do. I did some collecting when I first landed here in the 60s, and then veered off the path and came back, in the 70s, late 70s, when I was fishing, and I'd be coming in at low tide, and I'd start picking things up, mostly. At that point, I was attracted to the transferware pottery. Yeah.
And Paul, you admit to being addicted to searching for artifacts along the shore. What originally got you started?
Mm-hmm. Well, see, I grew up in a seaside town in Wales, and we spent a lot of time on the beach there and did some beach combing. And I think I found my first clay pipe on the beach. Near an old quarry there. And then when I moved to Provincetown in 1977, the beach was probably 200 yards from where I lived. And that's where I gravitated. You know, I spent many years fishing, sport fishing, I should say, just wandering beaches all over the place, and so having the beach right on my doorstep was sort of a natural thing. I don't remember the first object I found, but I would run into people who were also beach combers, and they would show me things they found, and pretty quickly I caught on. So that's how I started.
Yeah, Paul, would you tell us the story behind the white vase with the pink roses that's included in the book?
Oh, yes. Well, there was one spot that I would beach comb near the artist Pat de Groot's house. She would have been 90 a couple of days ago, and she would draw and later paint out on her deck. And she must have told me that a lot of the bottles and other things that she had in her house came from an area quite near where she lived. And I started finding odds and ends, pieces of clay pipe, bits of old bottles, different colors, and pottery, which I don't know very much about. Gail's more of an expert now than me. And I started finding pieces of pottery, white. It was a vase about 7 inches high. And probably about 3 inches diameter. And it took years of visiting the site where I started finding pieces to collect every single piece of that broken vase, which is from sometime in the late 19th century. But it became kind of an obsession to see if I could find parts. So I'd be out there in all weathers whenever the tide was low. And eventually I found all the parts of this and then glued it together.
Yeah.
And so that's the story of that vase. I think it's called a bud vase, and it has images of like pictures of castles and things like that on it, and then vining roses wrapped around it. It was the hunt that really got me.
Yeah, I was going to say, what a sense of satisfaction when you got these pieces and then, like a puzzle, put them all together.
Yeah, well, I think it's the aha moment. You know, you find something really special.
Right. Now, the book is divided into artifacts associated with indigenous people, whaling, fishing, playthings. But the book is not just images of artifacts. Amy, describe how you weave the history of Provincetown into the book with the artifacts.
Well, I would say that's actually a bit of a Gail and an Amy question. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the collections, for example, indigenous people, comes from Gail. And she has a lot of fishing objects, and so it kind of just naturally divided itself up that way. There were domestic animals, there were teeth, and I have experience. I remember photographing the teeth from Paul's collection, and that's a story in itself. So it just kind of happened organically because the objects were in separate categories. Hmm.
Gail, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, it's funny. I'm thinking about this. When the conception of the book was in front of us, it was daunting because there were maybe 800 photographs at that time. And, you know, each photograph of each object had a history. So it kind of all presented itself to make sense of it as a chronological history. So that's what came out of it in organizing it, you know, and it presented the story as well through the objects. So interesting that Paul should just talk about putting the pieces of the vases together, because that part of, you know, creating the concept, pulling the concept together, was like taking 800 or 600 photographs of these objects and making a whole statement out of it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it was
the visual of, kind of led the narrative too.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. I didn't really think about this till I was looking through the book and talking about, you know, the being on the waterfront at one time was not really where you want to be. There was the trash that was thrown in there, and it was smelly and dirty. And obviously that's changed over time, but I think that's something we tend to forget, right? And so a lot of these artifacts that you collected tell that story.
Yeah, it's called, you know, commercial fishing is called the fishing industry for a reason. I was up on an island off the coast of Maine some years ago in a where the fishing industry is very, very much alive. And it's the beaches that we used to on the Cape are very sanitized in comparison with a place that's a really vibrant waterfront where there are boat builders and people preparing all kinds of things that go into the fishing industry, and also dealing with their catches right there on the beach or on the wharf overhead. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what we see today is a much diluted and in a way much more beautiful environment. But there are remnants from all that history, you know, and that's much of what we find.
When we find a relic in the sand that we can't identify, it becomes a mystery asking to be solved. Gail, tell us the story of the ruby stick pin.
Oh gosh. it was quite extraordinary. So as my eyes are skirting around on the beach from spot to spot, you know, I always keep, and I'm still actively beachcombing, I always keep my eyes looking for a little piece of concretion or a nail, form like a nail or a screw, because I beachcomb where there was a lot of industry. And so some of the tools and the nails and the screws show up, and a lot of them are beautiful. I have a lot of nails that have square heads, which mean they were, I think, from the 1700s, and just aesthetically beautiful things. So I always pick up a piece. I would always pick up a piece, and still do, that's concrete, which is the, it's not an oxidization, but it's reaction of the metal with the salt and other chemicals, probably, I mean, natural chemicals in the water. And so I picked it up expecting that it was going to be some kind of an old bolt or a square nail or something, and I just flicked off a little piece of sand just to make sure it was something I wanted to take home with me, and there was just the tiniest little glint of gold. And I flicked another little piece off, and it was really gold, and it was about an inch long, and I put it in the pocket of my jeans, and I tried not to run home with that. I wanted to attract as little attention as possible, and went upstairs, slammed the door, told my children not to bother me, and I started very carefully flicking off each little piece of sand. And then as I did that, I saw the ruby embedded in the top. I started to see the edge of that, and then I knew it was something, you know, insanely crazy. So.
Yeah. Exciting, too. Paul, have you had...
Gosh.
Yeah, yeah. Paul, have you had beach finds that have set you on a research mission? I imagine you all have, right?
Yeah, I think probably all have. And my sort of focus has varied, you know, different times depending on what I've been finding. So clay pipes is something that we all have, and I remember finding the first whole bowl of pipe, and that was very exciting. And then my research into them and of how to date them and so forth became quite an obsession. And then many, many years ago, before the harbor was dredged about 30-odd years ago, I found an area where pilot whales had been butchered. And I discovered that there were these bones, which were the inner ear bone of a pilot whale. They were really beautiful, very smooth, sometimes patinaed, and every once in a while I would find one, because the last part of a mammal to decay is the inner ear bone that's extremely hard calcium. And it's shot through with tiny holes, little canals that have to do with the hearing process. And this was just discarded material that was left by the people that were processing the whales. And unfortunately, that entire area is now covered over with 5 or 6 feet of sand from the dredging process. And alas, not finding those anymore. No. But
right.
So that was something that was...
Yeah, that's very interesting. Amy, what artifacts in the book do you find the most interesting or compelling to you?
Well, actually, the inner ear bones of whales, when I saw them, I didn't know what they were at first, even though I'd been told, and I started photographing them. And then once I knew what they were, they took on a whole different meaning, and they're so beautiful, and it's so horrible as well. I think photographing, like I said, the teeth, any natural objects affected me one way, and yet other things like the pipe stems, seeing all the pipe stems and the volume of things that Gail and Paul had were the things that bowled me over. But just a simple thing, like looking at the doll leg that I found when I was 8 years old on the west end of town. I mean, that kind of got me hooked. But there's not any one thing, and sometimes it changes. But the pipe stems are a favorite, and I love the glass. I love whatever I'm really working with. And the things that I find on the beach are more natural than man-made. I've been getting into skate egg cases, and my new passion is sand. So the sand is where the objects are found. And so I've kind of taken another direction in, I'm actually combing the beach. I'm actually photographing it.
Interesting. Paul, the sculptures that you create often use salvaged wood. And since we've been talking about the historical connections found objects, give us, I wonder if you consider the past life of a particular piece of wood as you create your sculpture.
Oh, good question. Well, to some extent. And over time, you know, there are certain locations where wood gathers, and I get to know those spots, just like there are certain spots for other kinds of objects that are good for finding them. And I certainly think about what the history of something is, but in the end, sculpture is about form. And so I lean towards what a shape can be used for, what it can be, what other material it could be married with to make something, rather than the function. Although, you know, I'm really interested in functional objects. So, for instance, there's in the book, there's a page of knife handles that I've collected. Some of them are bone, some of them are hardwood, and it sounds rather ordinary, a knife handle. But when you've got 50 of them together, it makes a kind of visual impact. And that's the sort of thing that I'm really interested in sculpture too.
Paul, can you describe how the sea leaves its mark on wood?
Yike. Well, rust is something that I'm, Gail touched on that with the nails and screws and bolts and things that we find that have got concretions. And also sometimes wood gets caught up in a concretion. So you have sort of rust-stained sand and wood, and the rust is coming from metal that's actually in that wood or was around it, and that concretion builds up. So that's one thing. And then also you might find wood from pilings or perhaps from a boat that have been that have had marine borers, marine worms, digging their tunnels, boring their tunnels through it. And that's, you know, visually that's a really interesting thing too. So there's a whole variety of different ways that the sea affects materials, and it's just endlessly interesting to me.
Yeah, and flipping through the book, I was struck by the number of doll and figurine pieces found over the years, arms, legs, faces, little miniature items from doll houses. What can you tell us about the history of those items? Gail or Amy, I'm not sure which one would want to answer that.
Well, I can tell you why I was so attracted to them, and they're mainly not from my collection, but I grew up in a household where there was an antique doll collection, and I know some of my friends were really creeped out by it, but I find them beautiful, and I love the form, and in my own photography, I work a lot with the female figure, and so when I was a kid in Provincetown, the myth I was told was that, oh, there was a shipwreck of dolls, so that's hence all the doll body parts. Well, that is not the case, and so I'll let Gail take over from there.
Well, like a lot of the collections I have, the dolls, it's crazy. I know pretty much everything that I have, and I have thousands of pieces. I even my ceramic pieces, of which I have more than a 50-gallon trash can full of. But the dolls, where it takes me, each doll part or a whole doll, whatever it is, it takes me back. I'm transported back to the owner of that doll, being the owner of that doll, holding this piece, you know, of that was a young child's toy, and wondering, you know, were they playing on the beach? Was she there with a friend of hers playing on the beach with her little doll? So it's that kind of a thing that it transports me back.
Yeah. And the pipes, so many pipes. What are the pipes made of, and who was using them? Why are there so many discarded pipes along the shore?
All right. So they, are you asking me?
Whoever wants to answer that.
Okay. Well, Paul might add something to this, but because it was a working waterfront, and there was no stigma or no scientific evidence about smoking, men would be working on the waterfront and with a pipe clenched in their teeth, you know, and the stem would get gummed up with the tar from the smoke, and they would break off pieces of it, because some of the pipe stems were maybe about a foot long, and then when they were finished, they'd throw it overboard. So that's what I know.
Mm-hmm.
Paul?
Yeah, of course they're ceramic, they're high fired ceramic, and they're brittle. And they don't biodegrade. Mm. So if one imagines, I don't know when cigarette smoking started, but let's just say it was from the 1880s. If you had an industrial waterfront where there were hundreds and hundreds of people working, servicing boats, processing fish, whales, and then working in chandleries, all the associated industry, if those people were all smoking, or a huge proportion of them, smoking cigarettes and throwing the butt in the water, of course, in time, that biodegrades, and that biodegrades pretty quickly. Clay pipe doesn't. No. Archaeologists figured out, I think, what the average pipe stem how many sections it breaks into, and I think it was 7. So we... Between us, I don't know how many thousands of, and Boghossian, who's also in the book and has been working with beach material for much, much longer than me, he's got thousands and thousands of stems. And one curious thing that I've found is that the vast majority of the clay pipes remains that we find in Provincetown came from Scotland. And in fact, were made in Glasgow by different manufacturers.
Well,
I found
true.
A couple from Holland and a couple from Canada, but the vast majority. And I wonder, was somebody importing them into Provincetown as a wholesaler that had a deal with a Scottish dealer, a trader? I don't know. We'll probably never know.
Now, glass features prominently in the book. There are so many colors and fragments. Amy, with at-sea dumping and colored glass less common today, is it harder to find unusual glass on the beach now?
I would say most probably. I think that a lot of things are much harder to find, and I kind of joke around with Gail, and I'll say, you have found the last shard. And I know that's never true, but I would also have Gail speak to that, because the glass that I have is mainly from my mother's collection, and mm-hmm. I have a small collection from when my mother was beachcombing when I was a child, and so I don't have those kind of things in my collection. So, Gail, what do you say?
Sure. I find it fascinating. There are so many different sort of grades of glass, too. You know, I don't collect anything that's made after, I think it's 1907, when Owens was the man's last name, invented the automatic bottle machine. And at that point, the quality of the glass changed as well. So I have a tendency to just draw the line right there, and there's a certain quality. I can't even describe it to you. Maybe there was some other ingredient that they put in or that they didn't put in from that point on. But even a bottle from the 1920s, if it's sandblasted and rolled around, it still doesn't have. It's what I think it was is that the coloration. It's the coloration in the glass, the chemicals that were in the that they put into it, and I'm trying to remember now, but the earlier pieces were more earth tones. So there's more earth tones related to it, and it was also, let's say, if you were making beer or you had some, you know, it was about storage. There was no refrigeration. You wanted to make sure that your food stuff was properly preserved, and so there were darker bottles for certain things, and so a lot of that relates to. The earlier bottles that were very dark, the greens and the browns. And off the top of my head, I can't remember the alchemy of it.
Yeah.
It's when I'm holding a piece of glass that was from the 1700s, I have a hand-blown bottle that I found. It's about 5 inches high. It was, I think it was from England, but it was from the late 1600s. And it's the plainest-looking little 6-inch bottle, but to me it's extraordinary that it should end up in my hand.
It's probably chucked overboard from the Mayflower, you know.
Yeah, right. Yeah, who knows?
Right. Who knows? That's right.
Who knows? Right. It was there, you know.
Yeah.
It was probably in Mrs. Bradford's pocket when she fell overboard.
Is that the woman who drowned out there?
Yeah, Dorothy Bradford.
Okay. Yeah, the book also features found objects that are contemporary, namely a polypropylene rope, which has many marine applications, fishing, recreational boating. Gail, how do artists use that found rope in their work?
Particularly Judy Berkowitz used it in a very practical way because she decorated her hats. She'd make hats, mermaid hats, I think of them as being. Today, with all this flotsam and jetsam coming up, people are making big sculptures on the beach from plastics. And if you go on the back side around the race where the sandbars were, you know, that where the moon cussing went on and the ships wrecked, the modern day, none of that, of course, goes on, but the all the plastic comes up. Mm-hmm. I don't know of any other artists that are working. Well, in Provincetown, actually, there are some who do. You do occasionally see pieces made with the rope, especially the rope. It's beautiful, actually, I think.
Mm-hmm. Paul, can
it's,
collecting...
It's a popular material, that and driftwood, you know. Doing it,
Right. So, Paul, can collecting these found items become competitive? I'm wondering if after a storm or a particularly low tide, you're trying to be the first one out on the beach, right?
Yes, indeed. There are favorite spots that, you know, everyone has their own favorite spot. And a curious thing is that I found is that on a really, really calm day when the water's not bitterly cold, if you walk in just a few inches of water, there's a magnifying quality that the water has, and you can see objects a lot clearer than when an object is lying just on a shingle above the tide line. And I really like to do that a lot. And, you know, and I'm watching out for other people and interested to see what they're finding. And there's a little bit of competitive. Yeah, Gail Brown's got some very nice objects she's found. You know, I'm a little jealous of some of her finds, but.
Oh, maybe we can have a trading party someday. Because I, too, you know, are drawn to some of your little objects there.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
It's worth mentioning that this one thing that Gail and I both have. teeth that are probably from a sperm whale, which had been sawn off at the jawline, and they had they're approximately the same length, and they all have saw marks. And there's a story there which we don't know, but we both have teeth from that same, I'm certain, from that same whale. Mm-hmm. What that was all about, we won't know.
Yeah, we can only surmise, put together a story.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Well, now, before we let you go, I have to mention the book jacket and cover to the book. It's the first book I think I've held that incorporates texture. Gail, describe the jacket of the book.
Well, let me see. Let me get my book here. Are you talking about visual texture? The visual texture.
And also the sand, the feeling, you know, when you're the section there that has the sand. Yeah.
Well, when I was figuring out the layout of the book, I thought, you know, there's got to be a way to create some unity and subconsciously make a suggestion that you're looking at these pieces from the beach. And Amy had done a series of really beautiful photographs of the abstract patterns of the beach. So I thought to use those to separate, like as a backdrop, threaded through the book to keep that subconscious thought that you're at the beach, and I use them to separate the chapters. And it was our publisher, actually, who decided to throw a little something extra in there and put that texture to it, which I think is really wonderful.
That's brilliant, yeah.
And
if you take the jacket off, the hardcover is also a work of art. Amy, describe the cover.
Well, the cover with the sand, well.
Yeah.
I've just been really attracted to the way the waves, the tide, the retreating tides, and the patterns that are created. So I've been photographing them like crazy. When I take walks with my husband on the beach, after a while he gets frustrated and said, can we walk, please? I don't want to, I don't want to keep stopping every second, but there have been some great, great patterns. And so this was just one of them. And it suggests the tides and where the objects come from and the beach, and it kind of just sets the scene, really. The whole book with the you have seaweed and sand and postcards and things. It just kind of sets the scene for me.
Well, the book is Lost and Found, Time, Tide, and Treasures by Amy Heller and Gail Brown. We'll post links with more information about the book at our website, capeandislands.org. Amy Heller, Gail Brown, and Paul Bowen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Mindy.
Thank you so much for having us. This has been fun.
Thank you, Mindy.